This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Today's podcast is taken from a video interview I did with John McWhorter, the Columbia University linguist, who writes more wisely and often really about race in America than anyone else that I can think of. To watch the video version, go to reason.tv. But without further ado, here's my interview with John McWhorter. John McWhorter, thanks for talking.
Thank you for having me.
What kind of damage does a hoax like the Jesse Smollett case do to race relations?
Well, what's interesting about the Jesse Smollett case is that here's somebody who pretends that he's been attacked by whites, and when it becomes clear that he's lying, refuses to admit it, implying that there's some larger sense in which he's correct. And what he means by that, I'm not sure how clearly he's thought it out, but what he means by that is that he represents a larger story. The problem with this is that he is, one, making it so that some people will be more skeptical about actual attacks like that, because there is racism in the country. There is homophobia in the country. But then, on the other hand, he's also participating in something that we very peculiarly, especially as educated Americans, consider to be some sort of higher wisdom, some sort of duty, which is to pretend that racism in America not only exists, but is more prevalent than it is. And what I mean by prevalent is not whether or not you can tease out certain unsavory attitudes from people under the artificial conditions of a psychological experiment, but how much effect it has. And so we're taught to suppose that if certain racist biases exist in the hearts of certain people, then it's of this portentous import, and we're not supposed to ask what the import is. Now, if somebody is going to get beat up, yes, that's a very serious problem. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, people walking down the street and getting beaten up by white racist thugs is thankfully something quite rare in America today. It's not that it doesn't happen, but it's extremely rare, and it didn't happen to Jesse Smollett. But in terms of whether or not residual racist feelings have a significant effect upon the trajectory of black lives, whether black people are poor, middle class, or above, the truth is we are in a very new era, and it's considered the height of enlightenment for both whites and blacks to pretend that that isn't true. And that's the problem that we have.
So, I mean, and this is a long-running observation for you. In 2001, in an interview with Reason, you said that white racism was no longer the main obstacle to black self-flourishing. But, you know, and I mean, you just said something similar. How do you know that? Or how do you prove that, first? And then second, why don't we want to acknowledge that? I mean, it seems to be like, you know, something we could actually be proud of as a country and as a society.
Sure. There was a time when to be black meant that you were effectively shut out of dignified professions. You got your training as a lawyer, and you could not hope to be a prestigious lawyer beyond the confines of the
black community. So if you're black, you might be in a segregated community, you get to be the best lawyer there. But
that's as far as you were going to get. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the social territory, you were subject to regular open expressions of bigotry. That's just the way it was. I think of that as what the generation before me, as somebody who was born in 1965, which means that I don't become really a person until the early 70s. That's what the generation before me had to go through. And what was always clear to me as I was growing up was, wow, that's awful the way it was recently. And I was under no impression that it had been only, you know, black and white photographs of people in funny clothes 100 years ago. I knew it had been, you know, my parents. And I thought, well, what happened in the 60s really was significant, and it turned life upside down. And I knew that my life was not completely devoid of racist bias that you encounter here and there, but it never kept me from getting anything that I wanted. Now, I could say that as a very middle-class boy. If I had grown up less fortunate, then okay, I could see that especially systemic racism was responsible for me having a harder time doing certain things. But even there, we're talking systemic, not official and not overt. And even the racist biases were ones that weren't going to determine that you couldn't do things. And that difference seemed to me to be something to celebrate. I could have, although not very articulately, have said that at 11. I thought the civil rights victories that I've been taught about by my very passionately pro-civil rights and frankly not liking white people very much, grew up in the Deep South in the 40s mother. Mm-hmm. I knew what had happened in the 60s and I thought, wow, it worked. And as I came of age, I realized that I was not supposed to think that. And so how do I know? There's a very simple comparison that I often use. And I hate to say this in some ways, but it's necessary because it works. Here in 2019, suppose you have a choice. What do you want to be? Do you want to be a black person of any class living in any neighborhood? Or do you want to be a white person who weighs 400 pounds? Choose. Now, in 1920, I think almost anybody would choose to be William Howard Taft, even if he hadn't become president. 400-pound white person, well, you know, life wouldn't be great. You know, the dating market, things might be difficult. I might, you know, have some health issues, but at least I would be white. Most people wouldn't even have chosen. Today, no one would say, rather than being a black middle manager who, you know, once or twice gets pulled over by the cops for no reason and every now and then has detected certain biases, I would rather be a white person who weighs 400 pounds or a white person who has really terrible acne. Even that one, I think the choice is easy.
So what is, you know, why don't we want to acknowledge, and when I say we, I mean, I think it, you're right that, you know, most people in America for a variety of reasons are uncomfortable saying, you know, we're doing a lot better now. What is holding back people from acknowledging progress, and not like some kind of utopian perfection, but but significant progress?
It's a funny thing that's happened, and I wish that intellectuals and academics were more interested in studying it because it was complex, but it wasn't that complex. But we're taught not to see it. When it got to the point that conditions for black people were profoundly different from the way they were, the landscape opened up in such a way that you could have anti-racism. And the crucial aspect of anti-racism is that part of it is pretending things are worse than they are and not being open to clear facts that indicate progress. Anti-racism can take a place as a way of showing that you're a good person. That's the white version. And so there has been anti-racism, you know, since the dawn of time, but especially since the late 1960s. You can watch the Norman Lear sitcoms and the character of Maud reflected a certain reality. But something happened in this country about 5 years ago where being on the side of the angels meant that you were supposed to deny facts, that you were supposed to exaggerate, that you were supposed to embrace a notion such as that whites are supposed to be guilty of a privilege that they have upon birth and the evil of it cannot be expunged. It all started sounding like fundamental Christianity, and that happened in about 2013.
Okay, so well, let's get to that year in a second. And then what happened if whites started saying, okay, well, no, I'm really guilty and I understand and I'll be quiet while you speak. What happened, you know, what form does it take among blacks?
Yeah, the black situation was older and is only reinforced now. 400 years of oppression, 400 years of being treated like an animal. Let's say this is up through to the end of Jim Crow. It can be hard to have a positive self-image, especially if there's no single country to look back to as where it all started. So it's not like being Chinese or even Irish. So you don't have a strong sense of self, of strength. One way that you can develop a substitute sense of strength after 1964 is to become the noble victim. And so if you're not sure that you're good enough, and it's completely understandable why somebody would think so, then one way to think of yourself as good is to think, I am somebody who stands up under this constant oppression. And of course, it isn't like it used to be. It's in the air. I can smell it. I know it's there, and you can't tell me that it's not there. So that noble victim complex is human. I mean, I'm sure that there have been noble victims since human beings were running around in small bands of hunter-gatherers. But to be a black person is to have that as one way of feeling whole. All sorts of people have ways of feeling whole. To be a black person is to have that one available. And so I think that these days we've taken our place in this religious structure where we are the prophets. We are the witnesses. The white person talks about how racist they are, and our job is to acknowledge that they've said so and to absolve them that day of their sin. And that gives us a certain significance.
Is it absolution, or is it like actually, no, you're even worse than you thought. Because, I mean, it seems like that often is the case. It's like, yeah. Don't apologize to me because you're just saying, you're just apologizing. You're actually,
right.
Even in saying that, that's white privilege. You expect to be absolved of,
sure.
of racism.
That's a type. Yeah. I think that's more common in academia and among intellectuals.
Is this, I mean, what are the generational dimensions of this? Because, I mean, do your parents say, who lived in an era where racism was, you know, much more ubiquitous, much more pervasive and pernicious, mm-hmm. do they feel like, oh, overall things are better? Or are they part, you know, or are they like, no, things have always, things just keep getting worse?
It's funny, you ask about my parents, and it happens that neither one of them are alive. And it's okay to ask yeah. about them. They were both very complicated and idiosyncratic people. Neither one of them were archetypes of any mm-hmm. typical black story that we hear. But my mother was one of the most brilliant people I've ever known. I am her. Mm-hmm. I talk like her. I teach like her. But my mother was very much, she was somebody who participated in sit-ins, and she, frankly, had an indelible sense of white people as deeply racist. The term white privilege was not used as much at the time. But my mother was not going to let go of that. And I say with great love and respect for her that she thought of it as part of her mission as a black person continuing what was called in her day the struggle, to frame everything that she could as being about systemic racism. It's a mission that a lot of people of her generation who were intellectuals developed in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, I know already, I'm 53. My views on big things are not likely to change. I'm not going to let my views go. It would take massively contradictory evidence. You freeze. And my mother, at my age, had hit that point. My father was a different kind of individual, and it'd be interesting if either one of them could hear me saying any of this, but my father had a certain sense of self-love that was independent of larger events. He did not think of himself as a downtrodden black person. He grew up part of the solid Philadelphia working class, mm-hmm. and he had a lot of problems, but he liked himself. He would have agreed with the crop of people these days like me. You know, if he lived now, he would be patting me on the back and saying that people needed to hear the sorts of things that me and Glenn Lowry and Coleman Hughes and the rest say. He would have read, he was alive, but not reading too much by then, but he would have read Shelby Steele's work mm-hmm. and nodded.
Does it, I'm just, the list of people that you mentioned there, all male. Is there a gender dynamic to this that intersects
yes.
with
yes.
with racism?
I'm not sure why it is that when you give a list like that, that year after year, decade after decade, the people who are most known for expressing views like that are men. There are card-carrying conservative black women, countless numbers of them in the ordinary population, who people like mm-hmm. me and the others hear from. But in terms of the ones who, you know, are on TV and mm-hmm. writing for magazines, it's not as common. And Nick, to tell you the truth, I do not have a glib answer why, mm-hmm. and I'm going to make one up, however. I'm going to make this up. If there are generalizations to be made about the nature of men and women, and there are some, and they're just probabilistic, but of course there are some. If women are more inclined to network socially and to seek consensus, while men are more likely to assert by themselves and be lone wolves, if that's true, my sense, having known all of the conservatives as well as all of the just heterodox people like myself over the past 20 years, is that all of us are kind of lone wolves. There's a reason that there's no one organization. There's a reason why there's that one podcast where Glenn and Thomas and Camille and Coleman and I all get together. That's rare that all of us would be in the same room. It's kind of like we're all, not us individually, but it's like people who are black objectors are kind of magnets, yeah. kind of. And so, and I think it's because we're all people who kind of generate our own sense of self-worth sitting in a chair, drinking some bourbon and looking out the window. That type maybe is less likely if you're a woman. Hmm. That's the only explanation I can think of.
So you mentioned the year 2013, that would put us still in the Obama years. One mm-hmm. of the explanations, and again, when you look at survey data, you know, and there's limits to the legitimacy of it, but there's a real decline in optimism about race relations in America. Many people theorize that it's Obama, you know, at a moment which is, you know, I it's staggering, right? I mean, this is what a delivery on a system that had fucked up for, you know, hundreds of years. Like, we elected a black man, and that actually there was a backlash, and that made race relations more difficult. Do you buy into that, or does that make sense? Or then what was going on in 2013?
Yeah, I know that analysis is going to go down in the books because it makes for good theater, but no. What happened was that Obama was elected in 2008, and in 2009, which is now 10 years ago, and it's, you know, we have to work hard to remember what life was like before it. 2009 is the first year that when you were at a party, someone would say, "You're not on Facebook," rather than, you know, you're on Facebook. That was the year that, quote unquote, your mother was on Facebook. Mm-hmm. 2009 was also the year that Twitter really took off, to the point that, for example, my students were telling me about it, and I was saying, do I have to do this? Mm-hmm. That happened in 2009. So social media, as we describe it, became part of every minute of your life in 2009. That just happened to be the case. And so Obama is new, and that meant that something like the Tea Party could really jump in a way that it couldn't have before. I fully believe that if John Edwards had become president, there'd be a Tea Party too. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that Obama's race had anything to do with it, and it did have something to do with it. Now, a lot of people think that if you say something, what you really are supposed to mean is 95%, and I don't think that. It had some to do with it. Mm-hmm. It was magnified by the fact that life was suddenly in your pocket. And that is also why I sincerely believe it's an interesting what-if kind of experiment. If there had been no social media until, say, this year, and Obama came in, I think that America would have turned a corner on how it thought about race just because of the sheer driving presence of that family on TV or on your phone every night. But instead, what happened was, and this was good in some ways, cop killings of black men became a national obsession because it was in the phone. If Amadou Diallo had been in your phone, that would have been the moment. But instead, it was in the newspaper, something you hold, and then it goes away. Right. So Trayvon Martin, that ends up in your phone. That becomes a cause. White people all over America are wearing hoodies. As soon as that started quieting down, Mike Brown and Ferguson. And even though I think more and more of us today can admit that the story we were given about that was not the case, it had a symbolic value. And I think that that taught white America that race relations were worse than they were. Mm. And as a result, in 2013, we turned a new corner in how we thought about race. It was the beginning of whites being woker than black people. And so you have Trayvon Martin in 2013, Mike Brown, right after that. What happened to Trayvon Martin was horrible. What happened to Mike Brown was unfortunate. He was not shot with his hands up, but who wishes that that had
happened? But he shouldn't have been shot.
He shouldn't have. Yeah, he should not have died. And that happened, and more people knew about it and talked about it and worked one another up about it than would have even 5 years before. And from then on, especially the issue of the cops and young black men came front and center. The work of Ta-Nehisi Coates helped to support that. Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, I wish him well, but we wouldn't be talking about him if it had not been for social media and what happened in 2013 and 14. And as a result, it has taught a whole generation of white Americans, and not just a generation, but even older ones, that things are worse than they are, and or to pretend that they're worse than they are as a way of signaling your morality. A tribal feeling emerged. And it was because of Facebook and Twitter, which I would not give up for any amount of money. But social history has an element of randomness to it.
So you a couple months ago in The Atlantic, you wrote about the culture of hypersensitivity, which is certainly on campuses, but it's in other aspects. It's in the media and whatnot. With that, So what is driving that is social media, is essentially what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you and I, Nick, can remember what it was like to be, you know, leftwardly inclined people in college. And the response to offensive matter was quite different. And a lot of the reason it was different was because people simply couldn't stoke one another up the way they can now because of the phones in our pocket. And it's not an accident that microaggression is something that I remember reading about in some academic papers in the late aughts, and it was something that you only knew about if you were of those circles. It was in 2014 that my undergraduates started talking about it. And interesting, not 2012. In 2012, I'm sure I could have heard a pin drop if I said microaggression in a class. 2014, they're telling me about it. And it's around then that you have this clump of campus protests about things which left you wondering whether the concerns really merited the tenor of the response. Mm. And to be honest, if you went to college, even back in the 80s, you knew about these takeovers of presidents' offices, but the virtual epidemic that there was in 15 and 16 was a direct result of this new mood. And what's interesting, I don't hear people saying it yet, and I might be wrong, that was a surge that is past. It was a fashion. Mm. And I don't think it's going to happen as much now, partly because of a certain pushback among the chattering classes about it. But the reason that that started happening across the country in so many schools for a few years in the middle of the teens was a result of this new social media-driven hypersensitivity to issues of race, which also created a religious sense of prayer about race over activism.
There's a right-wing version of that, too. I mean, like, you know, Trump supporters are hypersensitive as well. So, I think it cuts both ways and then kind of feeds on itself.
You know what I hate to say, though? That I despise the president. And my feeling is that anyone who voted for him has a different prioritizing of concerns than I do. I don't think that anybody who voted for Donald Trump is social detritus. I don't think anybody who voted for Donald Trump is a racist, but it is a choice that I have a very hard time imagining making. And if anybody has voted for him, I often think their priorities are different from mine in ways that I kind of regret. Nevertheless, I think that an awful lot of that racial response among the people whose vote for Trump was informed partly by race is not just an outgrowth of the feeling that white people had about black people when D.W. Griffith was making his films. It's partly a kind of person who's tired of being told that they're a racist on the basis of a definition of racism that's so abstract that it's difficult to actually adopt a sense of blame about it. So we're taught as educated people that racism is something so abstract. It's racism if boys in Chicago, black boys, are shooting each other over sneakers every summer. That's racism because they feel that America doesn't like them. No, that doesn't quite work. That's racism because their father went to jail because of drug policies that were focused on both hippies and black people in 1969. You know, all of these things might make a certain formal sense, but the white person who's running a liquor store in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and they're not making it work, and they're worried about their job, and they're being called a racist because of this sentiment or that sentiment, they're tired of that. Yeah. And I hate to admit, I wouldn't hang out with that person from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, who's running the liquor store and is tired of the blacks. But still, some of their feeling is defensive rather than offensive. Mm. And that's not to say that I think racism is a good thing. That's not to say that I wish they couldn't be more educated about the fact that racism is not just burning a cross on somebody's lawn. You know, Archie Bunker needs some teaching. But there's an extent to which a lot of these people, I sound like Glenn Lowry, but Glenn is right on this. A lot of these people are tired of being called what they feel as a dirty name. And a lot of people on the left feel that they need to learn to understand why it's appropriate to call them that. Let's wait to see whether that could ever happen.
You mentioned Glenn Lowry, and you do various kinds of talking, blogging head video discussions with him. In a recent one, you guys were talking about, or maybe I should say you people, were talking about reparations. And this is a kind of interesting notion, which Ta-Nehisi Coates helped to reinvigorate a discussion of, going back to an earlier debate by Randall Kennedy. In your dialogue with Glenn, you poo-pooed the idea of reparations. Are reparations a bad idea because it's not politically viable or because it's a bad idea?
Oh, no. Reparations are a great idea. We had them. So anybody who says we need reparations for slavery is pretending that there was no affirmative action or that there was no Community Reinvestment Act of 1977. And you know I could go on and on and on. And so the question just becomes, is it that you think that those things didn't work and there need to be new reparations that would? In which case the question becomes, what do you think would work? And in this whole debate, it's considered somehow beside the point to make people specify, what do you think would work? What new policies would work? Okay, you're going to put money into certain organizations in order that they do what? And to the extent that it's considered kind of spoiling the party to ask those questions, it reveals that what we're talking about is religion. It's scriptural to say what we need is reparations. It's a variation on saying that America needs to come to terms with race without specifying what the terms are or even what you're talking about. What terms? What event? What human interaction are we referring to? You're not supposed to ask any more than you're supposed to ask about Judgment Day or the rapture. This is genuinely a religion. Now, the new idea about reparations is, well, one idea always has been, but the one that I sense people are focusing on now, is that you put money into the bank accounts of anybody who is black to make up for the wealth that was denied their ancestors. Now, besides the ethical problems with that that Glenn Lowry has identified, the question has to become, this wealth goes into people's accounts, and let's say that that happens. And so there have been reparations, and there's a ceremony, and somebody cuts a ribbon, and you know, there's some, you know, this festival, and Mary J. Blige sings, and you know, ex-President Obama comes and makes a speech, and then he sings Amazing Grace again, and it's happened. And everybody gets up, and Mitch McConnell even says, I'm sorry. After that happened, I wonder, and this is something, I could get along with the idea that that would happen if the black intelligentsia and black political leaders and black community activists could say, after that happened, okay, we admit that we have really turned a corner. Now, that doesn't mean that they have to say that nothing else ever needs to happen, but they would have to say, wow, we have overcome. Now we've got some sweeping up to do, but Whitey is no longer on the hook. And Nick, my problem is that I don't think those people would say that. I think that the whole call for reparations is really based on emotion. It's based on a sense of identity. It's based on a sense of needing a psychological crutch because of the hole that Jim Crow and slavery and redlining left in our souls. And so I think that after the reparations happen, everybody would just be saying, the usual people, the people with three names, as I like to say on Blogging Heads, would say, okay, reparations was just the beginning. Upon which I'd be thinking, given that there already were reparations before, now there are these new ones and you're not happy? Or the smart take would instantly be, I think it's problematic for them to assume that they can just write a check and have it all be over. And everybody would snap their fingers. Yeah. Well, if that's the way it's going to be, why do it? And so I could get on board. I'm saying this officially. Yeah. I could get on board with pumping this money into black people's accounts. I'd get some. I frankly wouldn't mind getting $50,000 for nothing because I'm black. Okay, that's not going to hurt anybody. But only if black America's leaders could let that matter. And I don't think they could.
Is there, you know, as you're talking about black identity and black leaders and whatnot, one of the odd things, if going back to the, say, the mid-90s, the Census Bureau started allowing for designating yourself as other or as multi-ethnic. People like Tiger Woods, my colleague Matt Welch and I wrote a book in one chapter where we were using Tiger Woods as you know, the avatar of a new multi-dimensional, mass customized, hyper-individualized America. He called himself a Kablan Asian because he was Caucasian, Black, American Indian, and South Asian Indian. And we seem to be getting into more, you know, rather than broader, more harshly defined categories. Everybody was kind of, we were on a gradient, we were on a spectrum. Is any of that happening now? Because when you look at the society, we are more multi-ethnic. There's more intermarriage. There's more foreign people coming here who hadn't been here before and mixing and all of this. But the identities seem to be getting shrinking. The number of identities seem to be shrinking, even as the social reality is this proliferation of types.
It's the religion. And so it's considered advanced to say, well, okay, that person may have only 1/8 black blood in them. But if they think of themselves as white, or if they don't think of themselves as black, they're in denial, they don't like us, they don't understand the realities. And of course, all of that sounds like Jefferson Davis. It's the one drop rule. And if someone like Thomas Chatterton Williams says, why are we applying the one drop rule ourselves? Well, that's considered conservative thought. you know, are we supposed to conserve the views of Jefferson Davis? And the idea is that you're supposed to let something that doesn't make sense pass out of a quest to constantly assail white America for being racist. And yet it's getting really, really delicate. I mean, it's at the point where, for example, and it's interesting, if my daughters go online and watch this in 20 years, my wife is white. And my daughters are, you know, in between my color and her color. One of them is closer to mine. One of them is closer to hers. Both of them, you might think.
So you're running a natural experiment there.
Yes. Yeah. And one of them, you'd probably think she was Mexican. The other one, you can kind of tell she's what used to be called mulatto. However, they're also growing up upper middle class in 2019. Culturally, they're growing up, quote unquote, white. I give them some of my black things, but they're white girls.
What is a black thing?
A black thing is in shallow things like cuisine, shallow things such as making sure that they hear a certain kind of music. And by that, I don't mean hip hop, but they're going to have their Stevie Wonder in them. They're going to listen to their Bessie Smith. They're going to have a certain sense of rhythm that you have to have by having certain music around you at all times. And I want them to have certain views of dialect that you have if you grow up listening to people speaking in different ways. But a lot of that is superficial. They're going to grow up to be just people. Now, if it were 1975, there'd be no question as to whether they were white or black. You said they were black because they were going to be treated as black no matter what. And that was true. But here in these times, that's not true anymore because there's so many mutts. Yeah. And so there's so many biracial and multiracial people. There are some people I've talked to where, and I don't ever let it get very far. I'm getting old and cynical enough that I know when to cut the conversation off very carefully by turning around. But I've said, are my daughters black? I'm not sure. And of course, some people are thinking, well, he just doesn't want them to be black. He wants them to be white. As if I'm some self-hating person from 1935. I don't hate myself. I would frankly rather be this color. But I just say, is it meaningful to say that they're African-American? I'm not seeing it. I think that they are not white. They're just mutts. And I've had some people tell me, white people, you can't know what kind of racism they're going to experience, upon which I just let it go. But my answer inside is, yeah, now and then, but not nearly enough to define a life, not nearly enough to, in any coherent sense, define an identity. But to tell you the truth, in conversations like that, I know that no matter how I said it, I will be regarded as heretic. That's the climate.
Well,
that
but it's, you know, you're talking a lot about a new religion, and it's kind of fun to be the heretic then, right?
No, it's no.
You don't think Joan of Arc was laughing it up on the pyre there? You know, you mentioned language and dialect and whatnot, and a lot of your academic work is in Creole languages, pidgins, things like that. You are a remarkably relaxed linguist. I think most of us, when we think of linguists, are like, oh, you know, I'm afraid to say, am I using who or whom correctly? All of this. Explain your approach to language, because it's really kind of a fascination about the way that language is constantly evolving and that it's a means to an end. And you seem to be very against the idea of insisting on certain linguistic etiquette as a marker of intelligence or class or anything like that.
Yeah, that language me and race me don't intersect much. It's, you know, creaky gears shift in my head. But if you're a linguist, and if you happen to be especially the kind of linguist who has a surface familiarity with hundreds of different ways of being a language around the world, you can't help but realize that any notion that putting it in this way rather than that way is wrong or unscientific or incoherent or not clear just doesn't make logical sense. Then the intersection, the tiny, you know, piece of flesh between Chang and Eng Bunker intersection is that, you know, contrary to what some people think, I am black. And I grew up listening to a very different dialect of English. People who were close to me, who I loved and liked, are speaking in this way that made perfect sense to me. So the idea that black English was bad grammar never made any kind of intuitive sense to me at all. And so with those two things, it means that if somebody says less books instead of fewer books, to me, the idea that that's wrong doesn't work because languages work in 7,000 different ways. because black people make as much sense as white people, and often more. And three, I'm a historical linguist, which means that my specialty is to know about what language was like before. And so I know that the whole idea of fewer books being better than less books has nothing to do with the way English has been since it was a language called Proto-Germanic, then Old English, then Middle English. None of this makes sense. So yeah, a lot of people think because I have a starchy demeanor, et cetera, and because I'm supposedly a right-wing conservative, that when it comes to language, I'm going to be very Winston Churchill. No, not at all. And that's not a pose. I'm not a libertine kind of person. It's just simple linguistic logic.
What are your politics? How do you define yourself politically?
I am a cranky liberal Democrat. I, frankly, if it were 1960 and people were drinking their cocktails, nobody would have any sense of me being in, you know, me being a conservative of any kind. Mm-hmm. It's our sense of race, and this happened long before 2013, our sense of what's normal about race went way left in about 1966. So that if I say something like affirmative action should be based on socioeconomics, that meant basically all black people in 1966. But by 1986, that needed to really stop being only about black people. That's not a conservative position. It only seemed that way because of this sort of Stokely Carmichael sense of where race is supposed to sit. And so a lot of people think that it's funny. Back in the aughts, I remember, yeah, I'm going to say it, when The Root, the publication The Root started, they called on my services and they called on me, thinking of me as, you know, they want to seek balance and I'm conservative. And it was the oddest thing I found that the writers at The Root actually thought that I was going to write columns in support of John McCain. They thought that I was supporting McCain over Barack Obama, who I thought of as the shining black beacon of political smarts. They actually thought that I preferred John McCain. The reason they thought that is not because they're bad people or sloppy, they hadn't done their homework. It's because they think that if a black person says anything that, say, Michael Eric Dyson wouldn't agree with, then they must be a Republican conservative. That's because of a strange aspect of our race dialogue, where race has been hard left, whereas liberalism otherwise has been quite rightward of that.
Will that ever change? I mean, one of my heroes, I guess, or a figure that I go back to on a fairly regular basis is Jackie Robinson, the baseball player who wrote a fantastic oral history of integrating baseball right before the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the mid-60s called Baseball Has Done It. He campaigned for Richard Nixon in 1960. By the late 60s, he was no longer doing that, but he... You know, there, and I guess Eisenhower pulled something in the 30s or 40s of the black vote, at least in his first term. Is that at all possible, or is the black political identity like so tightly wedded to the Democrats? And is that the Democrats' fault, or is it the Democrats attracting them, or the Republicans repulsing them?
It's going to change, and I think that social media is going to help with that. Yeah, you see somebody like Jackie Robinson, and you can't call him crazy. And yet his politics often didn't work in terms of what we expect of them now. And you look at those people in black and white, and they suffered a racism that, you know, most of us today will never know. And yet they came out, you know, voting for Richard Nixon, et cetera. And, you know, sometimes with, say, Sammy Davis Jr., it's because they were politically naive. But with other ones like Jackie Robinson, there was no naivete there. It's just that he didn't feel that racism should determine everything about him the way we do now. And if you had asked me 10 years ago whether this was going to change, I would have been pretty skeptical. But, you know, social media helps. And so it used to be that a Shelby Steele would write a book. And boy, was he lucky that so many people read that book in 1991. But that was unusual. And it was just a book. And most human beings don't read books. Nowadays, I think there is a critical mass of black people who are trying to think about things, most of whom are not Republicans, and yes, I am talking about me as being one of them. And instead of writing books that nobody's going to read, we're on social media where there are accessible venues where we can get our point across, such as this one, where we're just talking. You know, ABC News wouldn't have let me do this 20 years ago. They pretended they were going to three times, wasted my time three times, but I'm evil. As opposed to the other. Of course, they never said it. But, you know, Tavis Smiley gets his say, but I'm just wrong. That's less the case now. You can't keep me out of the media now the way you used to be able to. And that's also true of people who were genuinely on the hard right and black, and God bless them too. And so I think that we're getting to people. People like me and Glenn Lowry notice that there are people out there who are listening. And so I would imagine it's going to take a while. You know, a lot of the people who are watching us are young and or in college. But I think something's going to change. It depends on what sorts of candidates are put forward. But for example, if the Republicans put forward somebody who is not a moron and who is clearly a person of substance, but rejects the kind of knee-jerk, condescending identity politics of certain Democratic politicians, yeah, I think that that could happen. It's not going to happen in the next election, but start watching something different maybe happening in the one after that, depending on who's put forward. But the problem is that the Republican Party has become such a gang, it's a cage of apes at this point. And so at this point, the Democrats maybe will be all there is. Give it 20 years and maybe things will change.
You have been teaching now for decades, and you've taught at a wide variety of schools. Yeah, you're getting old. Okay, obviously you're dyeing your hair, but
no, look at my eyebrows.
But do you think universities are getting better or worse in terms of intellectual freedom and courage?
Worse. Yeah. It's bad. And, you know, it's not as
old. And is that not just among students, but among faculty
worse.
As well?
Worse. Yeah. No, the polarization is worse than it was when you and I went to college. And none of this is overt. And it's not that faculties are, quote unquote, tenured radicals. But the issue is what you're going to cover in a class for real. What's going to be said out loud? What sorts of behavior from students is going to be essentially tolerated? What sorts of programs are going to be allowed to be instituted versus which ones aren't? Most of it is underboard. It's kind of like racism. And yeah, I mean, if you're an institution that wants to keep up its endowment and make as much money as it can in order to continue, you are going to be pious where you need to be. And that's going to be the corporate understanding. And no one is going to stick their necks out. And so certainly I see people who feel one way as individuals, but it's understood that when they're in the business suits, none of that can come out. Now, that's not to say that there are people who aren't committed to there being free speech. Certainly that's there. And it goes differently from campus to campus. I can say, I'm lucky I can say, Columbia hasn't had an outbreak of student rage in the way that many other campuses have. And I'm not sure we're completely sure why, but there is also a strong, at least overt commitment to free speech. It hasn't been tested by anybody, you know, on Hamilton steps screaming for any dean's heads, but still there is a commitment to getting past this kind of gridlock. But in general, no, academia, it's funny. Talk about me getting old. Part of the way that I'm getting old is that I've been doing the race thing now for basically 20 years. I started in the year 2000, 1999, depending on how you count it. And one thing I've seen is that in terms of who hates me, in terms of where I get the most decisive snubs, it's academia. It's not so much the general public. I have my haters out there, and I hear from them sometimes, but it's nothing like it was 10 years ago, especially since I've never put out the stridently right-wing message that many people used to accuse me of. The inveterate core of heated despising of me is among people with PhDs, and I think a lot of them would suppose that they're correct because they have PhDs, but I'm sorry, the fields themselves are such that there's such a narrowing of what they analyze and how they interpret data that I disagree that I've done anything to deserve that judgment. And that's a problem. But academia is not the world. And so the truth is that the world's views maybe are going to be more labile than those of our most scholarly classes. And that's just the way I think it's going to be. Frankly, I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Well, on that note, we will leave it there. Thank you so much, John McWhorter. We've been talking to John McWhorter. He's a linguist at Columbia. He has written a shelf full of books, and he's got a lot of opinions, and find him at The Atlantic on a regular basis and all over the internet. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been The Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.